so-called linguistic
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. So, how are you doing today? Or as Terence McKenna often said, how are we doing in the here and now? How are we doing in the here and now? Well, personally, I'm doing great, and I hope the same is true for you. Even though the climate here in Southern California is always very mild, we still can notice the subtle change when spring begins to take over from winter. And although I see that it's still winter in much of the U.S. and Europe, and I guess you Aussies down under are now experiencing the first tinges of autumn, which is actually my favorite season. But I digress. Let's get on with the show, as the saying goes. And today we've got a fascinating conversation to listen to. It's one of the plialogues that we produced at last year's Burning Man Festival. But first I want to thank Joseph S. for his generous donation to the salon. I really appreciate that, Joseph. Thanks a lot. And I also want to thank Tame, Pope Natas, Fomit, G... Mitoth, Ozone 77, Hey Nani, and X... for writing reviews of the salon on iTunes. I hadn't known about that feature until I heard Dope Fiend talking about it on his podcast the other day, and so I took a look and found out that some of our fellow saloners have taken a few minutes to give us a nice plug on iTunes. And I really appreciate that kind of help with the salon also. You know, it may not seem like much to write a couple of sentences on iTunes, but over time, all of your recommendations obviously will add up and maybe be of help somehow to get the attention of somebody out there at the end of the line who can maybe use a little Terence McKenna now and then. So thank you all, both donors of money and donors of time. I really appreciate you all helping us out. Now, as for today's podcast, so far I've podcast the 2007 plialogues by Bruce Damer, Seabrook Leaf, Eric Davis, and Alicia Danforth. And by the way, it's John Hanna who we have to thank for sending me the recordings of most of them. As you already know, for the fifth year in a row, we had a few slight difficulties getting our own recording equipment to work properly on the playa. But thanks to John, almost all of the original playalogs were recorded this year. And today we're going to hear the playalog led by Daniel Pinchbeck on a hot Wednesday afternoon at the 2007 Burning Man Festival. Having grown up in a conservative, prudish Irish Catholic household in the 40s and 50s, I have to admit to being a bit uncomfortable at the topic my friend Daniel chose for his playalog. As you already know, that title is A Playalog About Sex and Social Control, Tantra and Liberation. And for me, most discussions about sex are like having that 800-pound gorilla in the room. But as I think you'll see, we actually wound up having a very wide-ranging discussion about some of the most basic issues of what it means to be human. It was really an interesting morphing of ideas across some topics that you wouldn't think would come up, considering the original topic of this plialogue, including some interesting observations about the Burning Man experience itself. So if you've ever wondered what it would be like to sit down and have a conversation with Daniel Pinchbeck, well, this is probably about what it would be like, even if it was just the two of you. Daniel is not only quite brilliant and one of the best read people I know, he is also very approachable, and he knows how to let his hair down and have a good time as well. So now why don't we just join him in the big yurt at the Pod Cluster at Black Rock City.
Right now I'd like to introduce my friend Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel has been a huge supporter of the Palenque Norte efforts here in La Playa. He started with us in the beginning, and he's been here every year, and he's really added a whole huge dimension to the Palenque Norte experience in the plialogue. Daniel and I first met in the real Palenque, and we seem to meet every year in the Burning Man Center Camp early in the morning when I'm getting up for my cup of coffee and Daniel's coming in from his night on the playa. So we cross paths here quite a bit. So please help me welcome Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel?
Okay, hello, hi.
So, yeah, I'm really happy to have more of like a forum or discussion on this area because I definitely in no way feel like an expert and wouldn't pretend to be so. I mean, I sort of have my own questions that I keep asking and thinking through. And definitely, like, the Burning Man experience has been like a whole part of my own process for sort of thinking about the sort of sexuality, the evolution of consciousness, of relationships, love relationships, male-female relationships. And I actually sort of had a kind of breakthrough in terms of, like, I was in a monogamous relationship that wasn't happy and sort of ended that, and then sort of went through a period of, well, while I was at Burning Man 1 year, returned back to home and sort of ended a monogamous relationship and just felt like it seemed like there were other potential models of relationship that were kind of indicated by this spirit of this place. And basically since then I've personally sort of continually tried to formulate what other kind of models, you know, could be and how they could, you know, sort of come into being in a different way. And I'd have to say it's, you know, been like, I give it like a, you know, pretty much of a failure. But, you know, I think a lot of people are in that same failure process. So, you know, I think that's interesting too. So, you know, and I guess when I, you know, in my book 2012, I was looking at this time as a kind of fulfillment potentially. I mean, the last speaker said that he doesn't believe in 2012. You know, I mean, I actually don't believe in 2012 either. And for me, when somebody says that, it's like it's kind of ignorant because to me, it's not about belief. Belief is something that we should probably get behind in certain respects. But it's about, you know, using our discriminatory skills and intellect to kind of look at the evidence that on many levels. And I think if you spend the time to do that, and hopefully my last book like helps people do that, I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that we're in this kind of very critical sort of evolutionary window for the human species, and that's happening on a lot of levels. From what's all of the levels are interrelated. Let's say whether it's what's happening on the, you know, biospheric level, the ecological level, the technological level, and the psychic level. And I think one very crucial and critical piece of that is the potential for an evolution in gender relations and in how people think about sexual energy, work with sexual energy, use sexual energy. So I remember when I was here and I was going through this whole crisis, I really thought a lot about the Kali Yuga, which is, you know, according to the Hindus, we're in the age of Kali, who's the kind of negative manifestation of Shakti. And Shakti is the deity that represents sexual energy, feminine energy, the energy that's in all manifestation. And her counterpart is Shiva, who represents kind of pure consciousness. So the idea in Hinduism is that the union of Shiva and Shakti kind of maintain the universe. And I guess it was this book on the demons of the flesh. It was on kind of like sex magic. It was kind of a dark book by this guy, by Nicholas and Xenia Schreck. But they talked about how that the Kali Yuga, you know, we tend to see it as, you know, we're in this dominator patriarchal culture, and it's the male energy has, you know, the male force has kind of overtaken the feminine principle. And I think that's totally true on one level. But then on another level, it's this idea that there's this Kali energy that is the kind of negative aspect or manifestation of the Shakti energy current, which has also been, you know, we've lost our capacity to control it. So it's creating like negative repercussions and negative manifestations. And I really do feel that one of the sort of critical things that's happening at Burning Man is a kind of conscious and subconscious interrogation of gender and sexuality. So I'm just gonna yapping for a while. And if anybody wants to, you know, has a burning comment to make, like raise their hand or go to the mic or whatever. So we're coming to the end of the Kali Yuga. And there could be a shift into, you know, from the Hindus, it's a cycle. So it would go into a golden age, which would be, among other things, a rebalancing. And you really see this if you look at a lot of different cultural archetypes, whether it's alchemy. They talk about the integration of masculine and feminine to create, like, the divine hermaphrodite. or in the Judaism, Kabbalah, they talk about the return of the Shekinah, which is the feminine aspect of divinity, which is something that, returns at the sort of the end of the of time. And so, you know, and one thing about, like, there's kind of this westernized tantra, and it's sort of an interesting corollary to the westernized shamanism or the modernized version of shamanism. So, like, you know, in a sense, like, you know, shamanism encompasses a lot of practices, but I think the way we've come to think of it now in this culture is that the psychedelic experience is somehow at the core of shamanism. I mean, people do the drumming and you know, the, I mean, there's a lot of different practices, but somehow the psychedelic experience has become, like, the core of our understanding of shamanism, I think. And by the way, everything I'm saying here is just, like, my perspective, and other people may have different perspectives. But so I think with Tantra, you know, there's a kind of Western Tantra. There are tantric practitioners who haven't gone through, like, Indian or Hindu training, who are sort of trying to work with sexual energy in a more sophisticated way. I mean, I would say most of them are women who end up, you know, doing a lot of work with men who have a very kind of low frequency in terms of their use of sexual energy, you know. So in just in the way that Tantra in the East encompasses, like, a huge body of knowledge and practices, you know, shamanism encompasses a huge body of practices. Somehow in our Western context, the sexual aspect seems to be the one that we've kind of focused on as the core. And I guess I would think that has to do, you know, if the idea of Tantra is really moving towards non-dual awareness, right? So you kind of reach a point where you get past the subject-object distinction, the self and other distinction, that intimate relationship of sexuality is where we have a big imbalance, and also where there's that huge potential for attaining that kind of non-dual insight. So when I was sort of going through my own kind of freak out and breakdown around monogamy and sexuality in our culture, you know, I began to read a lot about it and think a lot about it. And then there was that movie about Alfred Kinsey and the Kinsey Report. You know, I thought that was a really interesting movie, and then I read some more about it. That basically, when they did these studies in the 1950s, they were very scandalous. You know, they found that Kinsey, I guess he'd studied the gall moth first, and he discovered that this moth had, like, this infinite variety of behavior. And then he started studying human sexuality, and he discovered that human sexuality also had this almost infinite uniqueness, you know, that there was an infinite variety of sexual behavior, and then you know, I would say a large proportion of people who he was, you know, looking at in these surveys, you know, had non-ordinary, non-monogamous sexual experiences, and had often hid those from their partners, you know. So I think, like, what we have to consider is that if sexuality is this kind of infinite spectrum and everybody is, like, highly unique in their sexuality, then to just have a social construct of monogamy, you know, is going to lead to a lot of anger and frustration and hostility. You know, for some people, you know, monogamy is probably their natural state. You know, but I think that we really are going to need, if we want to sort of go forward as a species, really, we're really going to have to think about different models of relationship pattern and different ways of kind of making more conscious use of sexual energy, you know, for purposes of like consciousness transformation, spiritual elevation. So I began to look at, like, other possible models. I mean, if you look at a lot of indigenous cultures, tribal cultures, there's a huge range of organizations of relationship patterns. So, like, I'm reading this book, Society Against the State, which so highly recommend this book by Pierre Clouse. But he talks about the Gyaki Indians in the Amazon, and they had a polyandry model. So the women would have two or three husbands. And that was partially just because there was a preponderance of women to men. But it worked, and they had a huge social cohesion, you know. The Aboriginals had very different kind of models of sexual relating. In the Aboriginal culture, there was initiation for men and women, but men were really especially... It was sort of thought that women were kind of naturally initiated, you know, by menstruation, by fertility, by pregnancy, by their kind of connection to the earth. But men had to really be culturally initiated. They had to go through a a really long process. It could be a 5 to 10 year process of really difficult experiences, painful experiences, walkabouts. And without that initiation, they were not considered to be fully human or certainly fully adult, and they couldn't be married. So while those men were young, they would tend to be paired up with the older women who were single, you know, who were widows or whatever. And in that culture, older women, you know, were seen as maintaining their sexual attractiveness. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Things can be very different than our model of things. I mean, apparently in the Aboriginal cultures, when women lost their, you know, when women reached puberty, there would be an experience where they would be taken by a group of men from the tribe who would have sex with the woman successively, and that was actually seen as a kind of a something to be looked forward to and a kind of initiatory experience for the woman. And I think that's very interesting culturally, because it probably broke a lot of the, you know, kind of a negative and possessive energy that develops around sexuality and attraction. So then I was thinking about, like, I've been, you know, just sort of stewing on this stuff for a while, basically. A lot of non-Western and tribal cultures, there's a kind of like a basic happiness that people have. You know, I mean, our culture is all about the pursuit of happiness, but at the core there's a basic kind of general sense of kind of insatiability and unhappiness. And so, you know, why is that at its core? And in this book by Robert Lawler called Earth Honoring, he talked about how in tribal and indigenous cultures, you know, when a baby is born, it basically is never separated from the mother's body for the first years of life. So there's always this kind of intimate touch connection. And in our culture, the first thing we do is we separate, you know, babies from the mother and then put them in these nursing wards, right, where they don't even get nursed. So Robert Lawler, it's called Earth Honoring. Yeah. And so it may be that, like, our sort of the lack of continual kind of intimate touch in early childhood then leads to insatiability, you know, as a kind of so that happiness becomes this kind of very difficult and distant and unreachable goal rather than something that's just a basic quality in the human. And then I think also you can look at, you know, how different forms of sexual repression. You wanna go ahead?
Yeah. Okay. Hi. So what you said made me think of something. I think if you think about like what an abandonment problem is, you know, you're sort of like the psychological structure of if a child feels abandoned and it stays imprinted in them, they feel like there's something they feel like it's not there, and so you might want to test to see if it is. You want to prove that it is. The experiences that I've had where I felt abandoned, I wanted to prove that notion wrong. And so I would find myself sort of like testing it, wanting to see for myself, what is the real situation? Is she there? Is she there for me? And by testing it, I ended up, you know, making it impossible for her to be there, in a sense. So you end up having a self-fulfilling prophecy. And sometimes I think about the modern period in terms of scientific materialism as a cultural abandonment problem, and that the testing for God and nature is actually destroying the possibility of it being there. So I'm interested, it sounded like you were about to say, different ways that maybe through the way we, through the birth process, and mm-hmm. that we could resolve that from different dimensions.
Yeah, I mean, the birth process is one aspect. I also think, like, having, as I said, the thought that I've managed to give this, I don't think that the nuclear family is the natural model or a good model for raising a child. I think actually the tribal community is the proper model. So that's just a problem. So you have abandonment, like, you know, my mother worked, you know, my dad, they got split up, my dad was sort of unavailable because he was doing his painting. I mean, you know, you have these endemic problems because of this artificial nuclear family structure. And if you go to, you know, tribal cultures, you know, the kids are always around the adults. You know, they have special, I mean, I was in West Africa with the Bwiti, and, you know, different women would nurse the babies, you know. So yeah. so there was always that availability of contact and always this kind of trust scenario, you know. Right. So a lot of the problems we've created are created by this artificial nuclear family structure, which, you know, developed out of our whole civilizational shtick, you know, our agriculture and industry, and how we then compartmentalized families in these little buildings and apartments, then we have this kind of monogamy family structure is now kind of instituted in our laws and our tax codes and our architecture. So, you know, it really requires a whole systemic shift to move to what I would think would be a more natural way.
Could I just add something to the tribal family?
Sure.
I've gone down to work with the Shipibos in the Amazon, and typically the women can have babies when they're around 14. And once they have the babies, they are passed around to everybody from brothers and sisters. It's not the nuclear, so they're taken care of by everybody. So you can see the kid with like a big sister. 10 minutes later, Uncle Jose's got him or whatever. 5 minutes later, somebody else has him. And I noticed that those kids, you don't see any nastiness among them. You know, I come back here and I see some of these spoiled little shits, excuse me, you know, and they're nasty to each other and they're mean and there's all this competition for attention and all the sibling rivalry. In the tribal situation, they don't have that. It's all spread around. Everybody's sharing the love.
Yeah, well, exactly. Okay, go ahead.
I'm an only parent, not just a single parent, but an only parent. And my son has that whole, he feels abandoned by his father, and he is mean and nasty, even though I've tried really hard to raise him in a good way. And I hear so many people talking about it takes a village to raise a child, and here we are having this conversation. And I've had this conversation with so many people. But honestly, from experience, I'm still waiting for my tribe, these people who call themselves my tribe, to actually step up and ask if they can spend time with my child or offer some kind of remedy that's going to help him fill that abandonment hole besides just looking at me and saying, your kid's got problems, you know, and I can't deal with your child. And these are everybody sitting here. I mean, not necessarily, but I have a lot of friends. I know a lot of people, and it's everybody I know is here, and I'm still not getting that. I'm not experiencing it, and it's hard for me. It's a huge disconnect.
Yeah, well, I think I think you just have to recognize that this is an awkward and transitional period, and so we have a kind of like neo-tribal culture that's created a lot of like tropes and kind of cultural imagery, but it doesn't necessarily mean people have gone back to the tribal pattern. They're still holding on to a lot of possessiveness, a lot of, you know, like a lot of the sort of psychological structure of that's been constructed by the dominator culture of modern capitalism. You know, so it's a transitional process, and it's probably only, which I think is going to happen, as the mainstream structures continue to melt down, that those tribal kind of families are going to have to learn how to work together again. You know, at the more yeah so. The other thing I was going to make a note of was in my book I talked about. So, you know, I think we can see that this imbalance between the masculine and feminine has really been developing through civilization. And once again, if you look at the Mayan calendar, the long count is like a 5,125-year count. So it started around 3,100 BC, which is when kind of we went from tribal cultures to that worshipped the Great Mother and that followed the lunar cycles to solar cultures that created an abstract model of time, dividing the year into a circle, that had a dominator relationship, a priest class, and went from the Great Mother to the dominator father, patriarchal father, you know, kind of God. So along with that, we've inherited all of this really difficult baggage to kind of unwind and deal with. And then if you look at the beginning of the modern scientific project, I mean, Francis Bacon said, and I think it's an incredibly telling remark, you know, we must torture nature until she reveals her secrets. You know, so that's kind of like the energy of the modern scientific project is coming out of that, you know, really sadistic, anguished, masculine, energy, you know, in a way.
I'm wondering if you've thought of things in terms of oxytocin is a female hormone that's secreted also by men, but also a lot by women. When the baby is first born, that contact between baby and mother, that secretes oxytocin. Love makes oxytocin go off in the brain, helping people. Empathy, those are all oxytocin-centered. That's a hormone. Our society has worked on an adrenergic or a dopaminergic level, fight or flight or reward for pushing the button or for making the money. Have you ever considered that aspect of it? Oxytocin is the female force in a biological manifestation of it.
I haven't really. I mean, but that sounds interesting.
My question was on transience. So how do you see the culture pushing forward when in ancient times nobody traveled, really? You know, you were in an area for an extended period of time. Do you view that going forward, in order to achieve the tribal structure, in order to correctly grow people, that we're going to have to jettison the freedom of living someplace a year, you know, moving around the world for five more years? Can you simultaneously have the security that security with who your kids are with if all those people are new?
You know, I don't have an answer to that. I mean, it looks possible that, like, we're going to definitely lose some of our kind of planetary mobility in the near term as the peak oil thing grows and the kind of controls keep tightening on the system as it melts down. I mean, I'm going to talk a little bit about – I'm doing a talk on Friday at Entheon Village at 3:30, which is about my next kind of book project. And, you know, I think that we have this potential to move towards, you know, almost like we're in a revolutionary situation right now on the planet. And if you look at, like, for instance, the economic crisis that's unfolding, you know, what a lot of our, just like the man melted down on Monday night and the moon was revealed as this kind of little orb in the sky, not just like, you know, flash projection. A lot of our structures are being unveiled and revealed to us right now, and they're also in the process of kind of melting down and reconfiguring. So it's like, I think it's just a very critical time. So I don't know what's going to be configured out of it, but I think there's a potential that is very positive. You know, that we could create a kind of planetary direct democracy using the internet. It feels like something is pushing in that direction. You know, and there are theorists who kind of support that project.
Hold on a second, Dan. Okay, this isn't so much a question, but just agreement. I mean, there's two things that you mentioned. We're talking about the idea of going back to tribal models because they don't seem to have certain flaws that we're experiencing now during our cultural epoch. But you mentioned before the problems with your friends not actually fulfilling what they could be doing and just talking about it. And it seems that there is something constituted in the self, the individuated self. And you talked about transience and, you know, the sort of like technology and transportation. I think that these are the challenges that we have to deal with in retrieving the tribal models. We have to work with them. I don't know, that's why there is no answer, but we have to find that answer because we are individuated for a reason. You know, it gives us a certain freedom. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes up to the individual to let go of their projections and their insecurities in order to deal with these earlier models, because it's not the same as it would have been for the people in the tribal cultures. This is a totally different self that we have now. And so it's a new challenge, I think.
Yeah. And I think, like, one question is really, like, is there such a thing as a fixed human nature? You know, and if there isn't a fixed human nature, which I think is quite possible, then we can kind of reconfigure relationship patterns and relationship models in almost any way, you know, any way that works best for the largest number of people. I mean, and one term that I've begun to prefer to polyamory is the idea of transparent relating, you know. So I think that the only way that you can actually, like, you know, to go outside of the monogamy construct, or what is often the false monogamy construct, or the kind of you know, two or three year monogamous relationship, the next monogamous relationship would require, like, a very deep transparency and a willingness to you know, not. I think there's a boundary between, like, confessional honesty and truth. You know, like, confessional honesty is too much. It's kind of dull almost. You know, and just sort of, it's also kind of just, you know, almost like inflicting suffering on another person. But if you can find a way to communicate that is transparent and truthful, I think that's the best you can do. You know. You know, what do people? You know, are there people here who've had tantric experiences or have a particular sense of what tantra means to them, especially in the sexual arena? Did you want to say something or no?
To me, it means it's not about orgasm. It's about love and the experience, and not about climax, but about maintaining level and working towards that. That's what tantra means to me, but it's kind of an amorphous thing. What does shamanism mean? You know, you'll ask 50 people, you'll get 50 different answers. But that's what I. That's
so you're thinking more on a technical level. It's about the practice of for the masculine. It's restraining orgasm and sort of using
not fixating on orgasm.
I just would like to share a definition of shamanism that I heard years ago. If anybody's ever known a gentleman by the name of Christian Reich from Germany, he's a mad genius. And Christian said that they asked all these shamans all around the world for the most succinct definition of shamanism they could find, and the one that came out on top was unconditional love.
I think that there's a real problem with how we think about shamanism, because if you look at indigenous cultures, you know, we've now, like, we're looking for, like, new age heroes, right? So we've taken the shaman, we made the shaman into, like, a new age hero, and shamans in indigenous cultures are you know, ambivalent figures. They're boundary figures. They're often on the outskirts of town. Their hut is turned away, or their teepee is turned away from the other village, members of the village. You know, there's a lot of fear attached to traditional shamanism. To me, that's just like a whitewash, like a kind of invented, you know, modernist reinvention of what shamanism is. I mean, shamans are people who work with dark, you know, energies and light spiritual energies for purposes of transformation, for healing, to bring information to the tribal group. I would not say unconditional love is enough of a definition.
But that's just what he had said, but they do serve. Regardless of their working,
and sometimes they kill, sometimes they hurt. I mean, sometimes they use sorcery to shoot magic darts at each other.
That's true in Amazonian shamanism,
which is, you know, our kind of construct of shamanism is. I mean, it's a Siberian word, but I would say that the Amazonian shamanism is like the purest form that we think about. You know,
well, for me, shamanism is the basis of all religion, back to prehistoric times.
So, I'm grateful for the. The Plialog model, that idea of keeping an open conversation, and I've been really inspired by what's been going on. There seems to be a need for a co-creative journey, an acknowledgement of a co-creation, which this camp is a model of that, and a lot of the emergence is what that is. And I think that's what keeps happening, that we look to the past and we're trying to say, this is what we want, or we want to all be shamans, or we want to all practice tantra, or whatever it is. And there's a way to integrate that in, and so I think what you're serving with is bringing, a cohesion. But it isn't the answer of saying this is it from the past and bringing it in now. It's a way of bringing those things through. So, and also, just as a model of understanding Tantra for me, it has to do with kind of like what you said, is a way of building plateaus rather than climaxing. So the idea is building the energy.
That's not the masculine side. I mean, the feminine side is actually supposed to be like a deepening and lengthening of orgasm, just on, like, as I understand the technical.
Well, you're speaking about technical, and I'm not, actually.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. So I'm speaking about metaphorically or culturally that we create on a basis of plateau rather than climax. And at Burning Man, you could see it both ways because different people are running the energy in different ways. So I sort of started to have a little bit of a breakthrough around that, around climax focus and plateau focus, but I know what you're talking about, the feminine too. So thank you for creating this form, and please, everyone, jump in.
Yeah, especially, I don't know, have any women even spoken? I'm all embarrassed. They're like, you know, I'm just yapping about this stuff. Nobody wants to talk to me. It's so sad.
For me, my tantric experiences have been a mutual conscious connection in samadhi.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting to me when you go around the Burning Man camps, and I feel in a way there's a kind of, like, I don't know, a certain kind of, like, fraudulence or something. Like, I mean, I was just walking to get here or biking to get here, and there was camps like the G-Spot camp and the Perineum camp, you know. But you know, when you go to the camps, it's like the same old, oh, here's your alcoholic beverage, and, you know, there's some loud pounding disco music, you know. So I feel there's, like, this, that, you know, the camps are projecting this concept of some, like, deep exploration of uncomfortable, you know, sexuality depths, but then it really doesn't take place. Maybe it takes place somewhere here, and I just haven't found those camps. I don't know, or I haven't really looked. You know, I wonder what other people feel about Burning Man in relationship to their own kind of relationship patterns and concepts of sexuality and so on. You?
I would say, actually, it's interesting that you just mentioned that, because I have a great partner, and we've been exploring Tantra, and I do think it's really about also, like, loving with all the feelings that are there and loving with whatever comes up instead of just, like, being sexy. And we were talking a lot before coming out to the burn of, like, how do we make the burn an extension of what we're already doing instead of this sort of departure from it or just party or, you know, because there is that, like, there's this intense intention to come out here and have conscious opening experiences. And then there's this sort of like, bah, have a beer, you know. And I always struggle between those two because part of you wants to just kind of let go and open and go on the ride. And another part is like, we've all come together, these incredible conscious thinkers and planners and visionaries. And so let's stay somewhat lucid to create that instead of like running into each other on bikes drunk, you know. So I think there is that, there's sort of that struggle between the two, and it is a transitional time, as you said, so it's not easy necessarily.
And I feel there's like a change. How many people here have been coming to Burning Man for like 5 years or more? I mean, do people feel that there's some kind of like change in the gender dynamics? It feels like it's gotten softened a little bit somehow, or it's evolved a little bit. Anybody want to speak to that?
I changed.
Maybe that's what happened to me too. How did you change? You want to take the mic or give him some mic?
Go ahead, Locke. Go ahead.
I've noticed that Burning Man has become a softer, more open, more conscious model. And I think more it's developmental, in my view. Liberation is more of a continuum. So I would describe Tantra for me as more about liberation. And that just goes across the boards. So here, for some people, liberation is having a camp that's called the G-spot and sitting there with a beer. And for other people, it's coming together with your pod of people and having the most outrageous interactions and conversations and raising the energy. So,
yeah, so what is liberation?
Well, that's a continuum. It's just opening to more openings, I think.
I mean, I think that somebody said to me recently, like, freedom or liberation without discipline is just license. You know, so you know, I feel there's something to that. You know, like actually, then one of the things that led me to start this whole thing was Morgan Brent, who's a really interesting ethnobotanist and so on. He was talking about how you know, the whole concept of sex, drugs, and rock and roll it's a kind of a social mechanism to kind of take our natural vitalizing instincts and impulses and kind of distort and degrade them, you know. So and he suggests that the natural evolution would be from drugs to, you know, plant teachers, you know, from rock and roll to, you know, music that people create in their own communities, devotional music, you know, and from sex to tantra. So bringing a much, you know, using sex as rather than getting off, you know, getting in, you know, like becoming, using it to go deeper into consciousness, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Developmental process.
Developmental process, yeah.
So I had commented earlier on, you know, the Burning Man experience changing for me, and I think that in large part, you know, Burning Man is sort of whatever you bring to it or whatever you make of it, at least for me. And, you know, I know that I've gone the entire transition from, you know, getting ready to party real hard tonight, which what I would have done 6 years ago or something like that, to, you know, attending this lecture and getting up at sunrise and eating healthy and just, you know, really focusing in a very lucid and sober way on exactly what it is that I want to accomplish here and the kind of people that I want to meet and sort of what I want to do. And that sort of, you know, evolves into what Tantra is for me, which is just sort of that recognition of our separation from unity into this duality, and bringing that back together in a very physical, you know, material kind of way. So,
this is my first burn. Yay! but I came with a lot of stories. I've known people for 10 years who've been coming, and I've heard everything. And I expected a lot more debauchery. I've heard about, it's all about sex and drugs, and, you know, it's just this huge off-your-face orgy and some art. But I've been looking through the program, and I was expecting to see all kinds of, like, you know, find your G-spot workshop and, you know, Cunnilingus workshop and all this stuff. And, you know, I heard about the tequila clit shoots and, you know, all this stuff. But this isn't what I'm finding. This isn't what I'm experiencing at all. I'm finding yoga and conversations and practicalities and environmental awareness and, you know, cooperative effort and people really creating a community where anything goes, and in that there is the liberation and the freedom where people can make choices to be, you know, above or below. And to me, there we have to embrace both aspects, the most debauched to the most, you know, illumined, revealed, ecstatic, mystical experience. And to bring it to Tantra, that's really what it is also, is, as she said, bringing in the whole picture, you know, the awareness of all of it into the one experience of the moment, of the present. And that's what I've been experiencing here, and it's been blowing my mind.
And this is my 13th year at Burning Man. And it's definitely gone from more of a, I think it used to have more of a sarcastic flavor, in fact, to everything that would go on. But in the past few years, it's interesting to see that, you know, through, for example, efforts of people like John Hanna and Lorenzo here, and there's been more meetings of the minds and, I guess you could say, evolved consciousness. And one thing about coming to Burning Man is you are in contact with so many progressive or spiritual or new ways to look into your mind or culture. When you come here, and there is so much, I was thinking maybe it's time for a new type of Burning Man Festival, because as people are saying, if you want to have some kind of circle ritual that you're doing with some people, it's kind of hard to do that when there's, you know, a truck with a 30,000-ton sound system, you know, crisscrossing the path all the time. So, you know, maybe it's getting to be time for a kind of a Burning Man environment where it's more about a gentler path for people. So.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of other festivals too going on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I just would. I mean, I'm sort of interested. Like, I mean, I know Burning Man is fascinating, but it was, for me, my greater interest is always, as with the psychedelic experience, how do you take the, you know, visions or illuminations back into mainstream culture and transform, you know, the larger society or your own community or your own life. Let me see. Yeah, I was gonna. There's a Wilhelm Reich quote. How many people here have read Wilhelm Reich, some of his stuff? He's pretty cool. I think they have one of his devices in the energy pavilion under the man that nobody quite knows what it does, but maybe it does something. But he had a quote, sexually awakened women, affirmed and recognized as such, would mean the complete collapse of the patriarchy. Now, I actually don't think that's true, and I did think it was true, but then I had it up on I was talking about it on my discussion board, and somebody said, no, it's not sexually awakened or emancipated, it's sexually and spiritually awakened. I mean, I think there has been, you know, in our culture, a huge sexual awakening, but it doesn't necessarily lead to a higher social state. But I do feel that in the situation that we're in right now, you know, that it's sort of up, the men have kind of a role of kind of opening a space for a fuller expression of female sexuality. Does that resonate with people at all? What's that?
Not only sexuality.
Yeah, creativity also. I mean, another way I look at the situation that we're in right now is that, or you know, it keeps changing a little bit, but especially a year or so ago, I was thinking about this a lot, that it seems like men... you know, their primary blockage is their, you know, second chakra, like sexuality, you know, because of the of these, you know, dysfunctional patterns that you know, that we've created. And, you know, it's also really hard for us to imagine, like, you know, what it would be like to be in a culture that had a positive vision of sexuality from, like, top to bottom, you know, where it wasn't like this, you know, I mean, you know, as Lenny Bruce talked about, you know, the why was the word fuck a curse? You know, it should be like, oh, it's great, you know, you want to fuck. But anyway, I had a comment. What was my comment before that? Male responsibility. Megan said male second chakra, and I think women have fifth chakra issues, communication, because all the systems have been set up by this patriarchal system, so a lot of women are looking for their full creative expression, and it's still blocked because the artistic system or the literary system are kind of expressions of some kind of masculine structure, you know. So it seems like a lot of the women I know who are part of these communities, it's like their creative activity almost like falls like to the side or outside of the kind of structures that are in place, you know, for people to like get acknowledgement and have careers and so on. You know?
Okay, this is exactly what I wanted to hopefully get maybe an answer from or some discussion on, like, coming here. Cause I remember now. Okay, so as a man, I can experimenting with these non-monogamous relationships. I know what the problems have been, and I know what efforts I've done to deal with that. And what I'm curious about, I would love a woman's perspective on this, on what is the woman's role in terms of opening up this space? Because and concretely, this is what I've experienced. I dealt with, you know, you have possession issues, and ultimately, and they manifest through images of sexuality oftentimes, but really I think it's about intimacy, which is space, you know, and trust. You know, it's a connection between people. So I found that I've gotten to the point where I have no problem with sexual situations or, I mean, I really take seriously Rilke's notion of you have to stand guard over the solitude of another, even in a relationship. So, you know, instead of pulling them and pushing them, just let them be. And I've gotten to the point, I feel, where I can actually do that. But the one thing I can't do is, despite all that, if she comes to me and she's afraid that what she did or didn't do is going to hurt me, then her fear, it becomes a lie somehow. And that breaches the intimacy. And one thing I can't take is that when it's not truthful. As long as it could be truthful, and you mentioned earlier transparency, the confessional honesty versus truth. To me, it seems like the woman, and this is just an idea, I would love a woman's perspective, the woman has to find a way to be comfortable with that truth, comfortable with herself as this non-monogamous being, because biologically speaking even, it's not, you know, the psychological constellation of a woman is not exactly non-monogamous, you know. Does that make sense? What's the woman's challenge?
What do you say? What you find in studies of like animal species and human sexuality is that women do cheat. They're just much better at it than men. They don't get caught, whereas men blunder, you know, and get caught. Women tend to do it effectively, you know. So, but is that good enough? You know, it's not good enough. You know.
No, but more specifically, they do it very. There's a specific biologically. There's the during the menstruation, there can be a tendency to be monogamous in a relationship with a guy that will take care of the child, but then to cheat on him and lie about it with a guy who's an alpha male, because the alpha male genes will generate more alpha males. So in terms of evolutionary psychology, that's the understanding from a sociobiological perspective. And to me, if that's the way the female psyche is constituted from a biological perspective, then that means that what would be overcome would have to be that tendency to cheat and then lie about it.
Well, I think also once again, like I said, the Gayaki Indians had polyandry as a model. So obviously, other civilizations have constructed other models, and I think a lot of it in tribal cultures is that there's a basis of trust between the women. Like basically, in tribal cultures, the women are like together. You know, they're gathering, taking care of the kids. The men are going out on these initiatory walkabouts and. You know, and hunting and so on. So that the women have this strong base of trust. And I feel like if you look at like the modern culture, I'm in New York, you know, Sex and the City. You know, there's a kind of undercutting, nastiness to the tone around a lot of female to female relationships. And if there's going to be an evolution in practice in terms of relationships, women have to address that. You know, just as men have to address their, you know, dominator mentality and their kind of, you know, all of the negative aspects of the patriarchy. There's stuff that there's shadow elements that women have to address that are just as profound. You know.
I was just I'm struck by the fact that I don't necessarily think monogamy is natural. Like I think naturally, yes, we all want to I mean, you're always like, look at that, look at that. But I do think there's something profound about monogamy for what it requires of two people to kind of go on that path and be with those crushes as they come up, or all that noise, or potentially a non-traditional monogamous model as well. But do you believe in that? Like, there is a value to that? Are you saying sort of there's all different kinds of models?
I think that for some people there's a value to that. I don't know, you know, like what the percentage is. We could ask the room. How many people feel that a monogamous relationship is their preferred model of relationship? And how many people don't? Okay. My guess is, as social conditioning was to be stripped away,
sure,
that proportion that we just saw would change, and more people would be on the non-monogamous model, if it was something that was inscribed in the culture. Because now we have all of these cultural artifacts have been, you know, bombarding us with you know, on so many levels, and the social constructs. It's like, you know, we don't really know what we are.
Right.
You know, we just don't know what we are. You know, and sometimes we don't even know how to figure that out.
Well, and there was, I took a class in college called The Biology of Human Sex, and it looked at gay and lesbian relationships as a way of looking at the gender's biological drive. So with a male gender, the drive is to spread seed because that's biologically advantageous, whereas with women with a 10-month gestation period, it doesn't matter how many people they sleep with, they need a protector. So women, if you look at lesbian relationships, tend to kind of close in together, and gay males tend to sort of be more, you know, in general.
Yeah, I'm personally cautious about taking anything too quickly from biology and saying this sets what is actually going to be like the construct for humanity,
sure,
going forward, because I feel like the nature of consciousness is to overcome even biological conditioning, you know, to create something that is you know, better, you know, and that to me is a work in progress.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm one who raised my hand for monogamous. I prefer a monogamous relationship because I've gone through it all. I've tried out so many different kinds of relationships just to try it on. It was a monogamous relationship that made me think, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? This is ridiculous. This isn't how we're meant to be as humans. And so I opened up to years of exploration and checking things out and trying things out and coming full circle back to understanding, for me, I value a monogamous relationship with, of course, freedom. It's not like I own that person and that person owns me. I'm still autonomous. He's still autonomous. We can make whatever choices we want to make, but we value our intimacy together without bringing in or taking out a lot of different energies. It's just keeping it kind of like between us. And I've come to that through experience, through trying it out and seeing how all these different ways of being felt for me. And then it was a polyamorous relationship with a man who cheated and lied. You know, it can come back to biology,
right,
as our friend shared, because I was like, you do your thing, you're free. I don't have anything to say about it. And I felt it. You're with somebody. No, I'm not. Right. And then it comes out, and then I'm like, well, what's the point? You know, there's people, whether you're monogamous or polyamorous, it really comes down to respect and trust and appreciation and value and what's real in the connection.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like the hard work that has to be done is to reach that level of truthfulness, or truthiness, as Colbert would say. And most people are just not there yet. You know, they're not evolved to the point where, you know, they can, because you have to, if you're going to be truthful, you're going to get shit. You know, you're going to sacrifice. You know, some people are not going to want to be with you in that thing. You know, you're going to desire somebody, you're going to tell them the truth, and they're going to be like, you know, I don't want to deal with that. You know, but I think if enough people like can stand their ground and be courageous about who they are, then the whole thing starts to shift in frequency. You know, I could be wrong.
I have a question about this, and it might be kind of difficult for me to articulate this because this is a very confusing topic, but I'm going to try. Two points. One being, I think I've seen the documentary about that Amazonian tribe, and I believe that the documentary, maybe being Western influenced, sort of focused in on one male who refused to participate in the polyamorous activities. And they said that, number one, I think it was because he was jealous, so jealousy might be an issue. and that's probably something that we should talk about, but two, that he became the tribe shaman. And so I was sort of wondering, going back to what you were saying earlier about the distinction between Tantra and shamanism, like, I don't know, I guess for me personally, it's sort of difficult to negotiate the idea of sexuality vis-a-vis having some sort of spiritual experience, and wondering if the two aren't diametrically opposed somehow or mutually exclusive. So I was just wondering if, as maybe as artists and writers, you might be able to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, like, there's a lot of stuff there which other people can answer too, but some of the most transcendent experiences that I've had have been sexual, and some of them involved sexuality and psychedelics, you know. I also don't like the word spiritual so much anymore, because I feel like I heard it in the last guy's talk, it creates this artificial dualism between spiritual and material. And actually, if you think about, like, indigenous cultures, you know, I mean, Alan Watts pointed out that they were actually much more materialist than Western culture. We think of ourselves as being materialist, but actually what our culture does is we impose kind of abstract grids over reality, like models, and then we make, like, buildings in rows or in streets, whereas the indigenous cultures were, like, super attentive to, like, this plant, you know, that rock, that river, you know. So in actuality, they were more deeply material, and the spiritual and the material could not be separated or cut apart in that kind of thing. So I think that So I think there's a lot of problems. As soon as we talk about spirituality, we've alienated ourselves from something in a way. Jealousy is obviously a huge thing here. And so, you know, one question is, like, is pain a bad thing? You know, I mean, there's a really interesting book called Pain, Sex, and Time by this guy Gerald Hurd, and he looked at the human capacity for sexual appetite of the human species, and our capacity for suffering are completely beyond our needs purely as a species. And for him, that suggested to him that there was a kind of extra evolutionary energy in those aspects of the human nervous system that could lead to a kind of a psychic evolution. You know, so, you know, for instance, potentially on a very high level, like working through jealousy and finding non-attachment from jealousy could be a very profound, I'm going to use the word spiritual, could be a very profound consciousness experience to make that shift. And it's not going to be an easy thing to do. You know, it's a very deeply ingrained aspect of our psyche. You know.
to sort of bring Tantra and non-monogamy together a little bit. I'm very new to tantric practice. One of the things to me that it seems like it's a powerful way to sort of for souls to come together and make love, as opposed to just an ego-based kind of two individuals. You know, it's like somehow you're getting kind of beyond that self, and it's embodying, you know, masculine energy, feminine energy, kind of in a more general sphere. I have had experience with polyamorous relationships as well. One of the things that keeps me interested in that is the fact that it seems like a doorway to be meeting, having those soul meetings on a scale that goes beyond just one, you know, partner for the rest of your life or something. But I kind of wonder how those things might come together in terms of this sort of spiritual awakening, or as tantric practice maybe becomes more widespread, how I don't know how that fits in with.
Yeah, I mean, one aspect of traditional tantra apparently in the East is that, like, your, you know, somebody's tantric partner would not be their main relationship partner. It wasn't seen as possible generally for those two types of relationships to be with the same person. I also got interested once again in that Robert Lawler book, Earth Honoring, which is about kind of like a new model for male sexuality. He talks about that, you know, and so it's from the male, you know, it's about male sexuality, but he talks about there's, in his perspective, kind of a natural rhythm in masculine sexuality, so that in your, like, 20s, you know, you desire, like, that romantic relationship, but then when you get older, maybe you desire what he talks about as more like a ritualized sexual experiences, which, you know, in other cultures, traditional cultures, would be satisfied through, like, temple priestesses and so on. So we don't have that, so that leads men to leave their wives. They're in search of this thing. They don't even know what it is. And it's not just another relationship. It's actually a kind of sacralized experience of sexuality in a kind of ritual context. I thought it was interesting.
Okay, so what I'm feeling a thread around consciousness within that and conscious behavior, and then the relationship of conscious behavior with honesty, and then so consciousness in relation to being honest with others, but also consciousness and being honest with self. So, and that in the model of creating at the level of community. So in a way, to create a foundation for that type of evolution, you need partners or allies that are pretty close to you in that way. So I think that might be part of the reason that we have still, we're still figuring out how to create, you know, what would be new, a new expression of that. So part of where, in a sense, what I see working or effective about holding to a monogamy in a tantric practice is the aspect of working with someone and creating a sacred, safe space to work in where you're cultivating an awareness of each other and a knowledge of each other on that journey. And that's an aspect of evolution and self-evolution, because we didn't start out in a culture where it already existed. So as we're creating something that, you know, in a sense, generationally, it might evolve, but at this point, I feel like we're creating it right now. So in that sense of radical honesty and radical behavior, radical expression, that feels like this is the field for that creation. Yeah. And it's non-dual. I think the aspect of becoming non-dual is a paradoxical hinge point where we are not separate from each other, you know, and then we're experiencing that separateness, or we're not separate from all that is, you know, in that sense. So,
I just briefly wanted to share a little fantasy that I have. I came to the Burning Man community shortly after a brief marriage to a man ended, and it was a period of great self-exploration and expansion. And I was a bit taken aback when I came into this community, because I found I was being sexually approached by women more than men, and it precipitated some real deep self-doubts. I'm strongly identified as a heterosexual monogamous woman, but I really felt as if I was not interesting enough for this community. I was not open-minded enough. I didn't have a healthy curiosity. But eventually, maybe one of the gifts of middle age was accepting, no, I really am a heterosexual monogamous woman, and that's fine. And addressing what we were talking about earlier, in the 4 years I've been a part of this community, I seem to sense more of a free to be you and me kind of
My mother
atmosphere.
Edited that book, actually.
Right on. and the fantasy I wanted to share about the age when I was becoming aware of what homosexuality was, it was introduced to me as the men who wear their earring in whichever ear. And I'm hoping as we evolve as a tribal community, we may develop ways to sort of signal who we are and what we want more clearly, so that some of that ambiguity is resolved. And you can just be who you are, and maybe others who share similar preferences will be more recognizable to you. So,
hi, I'm very grateful that you're here and you're answering these things, but I have a question. When I come out to Burning Man, I bring with me certain things, and I'm looking for a journey. And my particular journey is to continue to grow with enlightenment and spirituality. I mean, absorb it in me. There was a little conversation earlier. You've asked many good questions, and one of them was, you know, talked about bringing alcohol out here. And I think, like, one of the things I'm interested in doing is to, at night, have a good time, light myself up, dance, and, you know, have a few sips on a cocktail or something like that. And I find that the two things from all of my research and understanding is it's very difficult to connect spiritually when you're, you know, connecting with alcohol. And I have one, and I want to ask, like,
which is funny, because if you think about, you know, another name for alcohol is spirits.
Right, and it kind of, and in a sense, it can take you certain places, of course. But one thing that I found, and I wanted to say to you, is that even if you are going to have that beer or something else like that, the absorb it like all food that you take on the ply or wherever else, and it's a blessing. It's like eating a peach when it's warm is like it's a gift.
Well, you know, I mean, when, you know, and also like the tantric path is like, you know, you don't avoid anything. You know, you take it all, you know, and the idea is to use the sensory realm to go through it, and so that it doesn't even haunt you anymore, you know. And I mean, there's this occultist, Julius Evola, who he's kind of weird a little bit. There's an Italian baron kind of associated with fascism a little bit, but he's still pretty interesting and a little nasty. But he talks about, he has a book on Tantra and sexuality. He talks about how, you know, for his perspective, the purpose of Tantra is not to kind of empower or intensify human nature. It's actually to cauterize it, you know, so that you can actually go beyond human nature. You know.
Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel, for answering these questions and for everyone for having this conversation. My question is related to the idea of evolution, which I guess I'm taking it as a metaphor in your writing, because essentially the way that I see it is that evolution in the natural world is an almost purely random and unplanned phenomenon where there's a changing environment. And then, you know, a sort of random sequence of mutations, and then, you know, selection. What I think you're talking about doing is much more about us consciously planning where we want to go. And so, you know, with that said, I'm curious why the word seems to appeal to you, or why you use that word.
It's interesting. Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, some of the theorists that I used in 2012 use it, like Rudolf Steiner and Teilhard de Chardin, basically that there's a, you know, Arguelles, that we've had this physical evolution to a certain point, and now that the evolution has moved from the physical to the psychic realm, you know, and so that's where evolution is now taking place, and where it was the biosphere, it's now the newosphere, you know, so that we're evolving on another level, which is this psychic consciousness level.
Has that happened before? Can we look at historical precedents for such a thing? Or I mean, that was the point in the book that was most difficult.
The movement of physical evolution seems to be one of, I guess, punctuated equilibrium. Uh-huh. Like there's, like, you know, development sort of reaches a certain level, kind of plateau, and then there's this, like, jump into a much higher level of complexity and higher level of consciousness and awareness. You know, so Noam Chomsky talked about how you can't see that a kind of linear progression from animal communication to human speech. It was like this whole new system suddenly appeared in the brain. So it had to have been like a sort of leapfrog. You know, and it seems to me that my hypothesis when I look at you know, where we're at as a species, is that we're on the verge of another such quantum leap into a different order, you know, which may even involve, like, a different mental structure, you know, different physical structures in the brain. Who knows? You know, it's like, you know, who knows how that happens? I mean, it may be that, you know, genetics and consciousness are more linked, you know, than we know at this point. You know?
And I'm sorry to hog the mic in this way, but another question that occurred to me from reading the book was, was this something that you imagined happening in a few people and then spreading, or happening to, like, a larger number of people more suddenly? It seems like a big difference between those two things.
Well, I really like this idea of, like, a morphogenetic fields, in, you know, morphic resonance, the Rupert Sheldrake ideas. You know, so Rupert Sheldrake talks about how, like, we have this idea that the laws of the universe are laws. You know, they're immutable and permanent. But actually, that concept of physical laws was developed, you know, in the 17th century by science, you know, based on their Christian conditioning, that there was this immutable God in heaven who knew everything, right? So Sheldrake posits, rather than laws, there might be more like habits, you know, or patterns. You know, so like a crystal forms for the first time, that creates like a new morphogenetic field for crystals forming. And then it becomes more and more commonplace when those combination, that sort of combination appears, crystals form. And then he talks about how that could also be true for thought forms, you know, so you know, often you'll see there's like a same scientific breakthrough will happen, you know, almost simultaneously in a few places on the planet. It's like that morphogenetic field has just opened for new possibility. And so that might be, you know, if we're in this area where there's like increasing novelty, increasing creativity, it may be that new habitual patterns are being formed, like new kind of psychic fields of possibility, which could then become really widespread really quickly. You know, like democracy was an idea that occurred to somebody, you know, or a couple people, you know, then they figured out how to transmit it, and then it became, you know, a huge phenomenon.
We have time for maybe three or four more comments and all. We're going a little over, which is great. I do have to get the sound crew out in time so they can get ready for tonight, and I'm part of the sound crew. But, yeah, we have time for three or four more. I want everybody to have a chance to talk that hasn't had a chance yet.
You mentioned that you were moving towards an idea of, was it transparent communication?
Transparent relating.
Relating, rather than the kind of honesty that might just hurt people.
Say that again?
Rather than, I thought you said, the kind of honesty that might just hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you could expand on that. Like, what is the difference? When is honesty not honesty? What's good honesty and what's bad honesty?
Well, I was talking about transparent relating compared to monogamy or polyamory or any gami or ori or whatever. That might just be... It's just like giving another way of thinking about it. You know, I can't... Sometimes it helps to kind of have like a language switch. And for me, transparent relating is, it's kind of like what the woman in white was saying. Like, you know, if there was a way to signal like who you are and how you are, you know, and make it really clear, you know, rather than it being this kind of, you know, the kind of mechanisms that we now have, which lead into a lot of like deception and people, you know, concealing their own feelings from themselves and then from others, and then those manifesting as, you know, channeled aggression and, you know, so on. So the more you know yourself and the more you're willing to be transparent, I think the better that you can do, you know, for yourself and others, you know.
So is being transparent setting parameters of respect and then not letting on every single detail, or?
Being transparent is, as much as possible, being willing to just be where you are, you know, about sexuality or relationships, as we're discussing, you know, like, I mean, you know, I, for a while I was experimenting in New York disastrously, like whenever I went on a date with somebody, I'd be like, look, you know, I think you're awesome, I'd love to hang out, you know, I just really don't think that I'm monogamous, you know, at least right now. And almost every time, like, the door, you know, would slam shut at that point, because New York still has that kind of rigid kind of attitude around sexuality. And I'm still glad that I did that. I mean, I ultimately kind of began to moderate a little bit, you know, but you know, in a way, be exactly who you are, and you'll find eventually you'll have to find people who are part of your tribe on that level, you know. Or you'll just be alone and you'll get used to that. And then I had a date with an astrologer, and you know, I hadn't really talked to her about this stuff. She wanted to know my birth date and where I was from. And so we sit down for a drink, and she's like, look, you know, I really like you, but, you know, we're just not going to date. I did your chart, and you were just not monogamous. You know, so.
Aloha. This is my first burn, and I'm so humbled and thankful for all of you being you. And... just recently, I was a part of this community and for a few years with all these beautiful people and in Hawaii, and they evolved into this polyamorous group. And my husband and I had explored that separately when we were younger, and we really loved all these people, and they kept putting all this pressure on us to join them and they would tell us that we had some sort of sexual blocks and insecurities, and why couldn't we get to that, and all of these things that were really, really challenging. And it brought me to this awareness that for me, and maybe, you know, I'm not really educated in Tantra, but my concept of my evolution with Tantra is getting to a place within myself where I don't need to have sex with someone. That my ecstatic energy and their ecstatic energy in the now are there. And so it's really beautiful, and I love it, and I try to convey that to them. And
That's fine.
Yeah, I
I don't think anybody would disagree. Like, you know, I mean, you know,
But I guess I'm just a little confused about Tantra and this evolution of Tantra, and is that like a concept that's a current like paradigm, or is this just my reality?
Well, I mean, it could be, you know, tantric practice could just be like sitting across from somebody, staring into their eyes with your hand on their heart or whatever. I mean, and just, you know, breathing together. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, sexual. It's just like it seems that, you know, just as the way shamanism tends towards the psychedelic experience, you know, our Western kind of concept of tantra would tend towards like a intimate sexual experience. You know. But I could be wrong.
Okay. It's a good thing that the man got burned, because we've been turning in circle. And I think what Jose Arguelles is saying about like the end of time, it's the end of that time of just turning in circle and not knowing what we're doing or where we're going and running after happiness. And it's a shift in consciousness. So we all use the word consciousness. And ayahuasca helped me understand the shift in consciousness. It's like, let's say a person that is blind, and you describe to him this beautiful scenery, sunset, but he's blind. So you can describe and describe and describe. So a shift in consciousness is like opening this new window, going to this other dimension. And we're almost there, and psychedelic is a way to just access for a short time on that side. Most of the people here maybe don't understand. They're just, But it's there, and it's real. And I did not agree with the first talk we had with John Hanna. John Hanna is his name. Because he said no, that he didn't believe that. But I do believe it because I've been there. I, like, died in ayahuasca, and I had that, like, that epiphany, and I contacted these multi-dimensions, and I know they are here now. It's just a shift in consciousness. So consciousness is like, if I tell you, think about a lemon, then you can see the yellow color and the flavor and the smell and all that, and your consciousness is there at that moment because you're thinking about a lemon. But if you can shift your consciousness to another dimension, then you can be there also. You have the power to do it. So that's what I wanted to say.
So we stop? Okay, cool. That was fun. I hope, did everybody enjoy that? It was interesting. All right, cool.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking time out of your Burning Man experience to share with us.
So please come to this talk on Friday if you want to. Entheon Village, 3:30. I think it's going to be interesting. Okay, thanks. Bye.
And you can hear a lot more of Daniel on the Psychedelic Salon podcast, too. So he's been with us since the beginning. Thanks again, Daniel.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
And that lovely voice you just heard was none other than the famous Black Beauty, or BB as her friends call her. And you can catch her monthly podcast from BB's Bungalow at the end of each month on the Cannabis Podcast Network over at dopefiend.co.uk. And while I'm thinking of it, if you want to meet some people like the ones who participated in the Plyologues, you can do just that and probably a lot more at the upcoming Dope Stock Gathering in Amsterdam. And I'll put the link to the details along with the notes to this podcast, but if you go to dopefiend, dopefiend.co.uk, you go to that website, you'll find all of the information about this annual event. Basically, this gathering is held each year on the 20th of April, 420, and it's organized, and I guess I should use that word somewhat loosely, but it's coordinated by my good friend Dope Fiend. In the past, you've heard me and many of our guests say how we ultimately met most of our friends at conferences. And while the recent extravaganza in Basel with around 1,500 people there would have been a good connecting point, the problem was that in addition to your travel expenses, the cost of admission was quite high. And like most reports I've read about the conference, what they say is that the best feature seemed to be the new friends that were made. Well, there's no entrance fee for Dopestock, where the entire focus is on having great fun and good conversation with your new best friends. Even though I've never met BB, Dope Fiend, Max, Freakout, Lefty, or any of the other podcasters on their network, I feel as if I've been friends with them all of my life. And my hunch is that anyone who shows up in Amsterdam on the 20th of April this year is going to wind up forging some lifelong friendships of their own. You know, it's a little too far for me to travel myself, but if any of our fellow saloners can make it to Dopestock, I know you won't be disappointed. Now, getting back to today's podcast, at the end, Daniel mentioned another talk that he was planning on giving in a couple of days there at Burning Man, but as it turned out, so I'm told, Daniel's 3:30 Friday talk really turned into a wing doozy as that massive whiteout that came through just then. You know, it was on the same day that, on the same time that blew the top out of our yurt, and I hear it really did a job on the big dome over in Theon Village where Daniel was speaking. But since I wasn't there, you'll have to ask somebody who was there to give you the details. But from what I hear, it it must have been really exciting. So now do you see what I mean about a wide-ranging discussion? Considering that this discussion was billed as a plialogue about sex and social control, tantra and liberation, and it began with Daniel saying, and I quote, "I think there is a lot of evidence that suggests we're in this kind of very critical sort of evolutionary window for the human species." And then an hour later, we ended more or less with a testimonial to the spiritual power of ayahuasca. And, of course, there was also a lot of frank discussion about human sexual relations. But all in all, while it may not be your usual street corner conversation in Middletown, USA, it's probably about par for the course in Black Rock City. Now, one thing I want to be sure that we don't lose sight of, however, is a statement one young woman made early in this plialogue when she described herself as an only parent and that her close friends, her tribe, still hadn't stepped up and offered to become involved in helping her raise her son. And I wish there had been more time to continue that line of thought because I think it goes to the core of what we're all dreaming of and longing for here, which is some kind of a close community, both in physical locality and in state of consciousness. You know, our clan, our tribe, the ones who are always there for us when we need them. And so I've been thinking a lot lately about what we can do about what that young mother said, and I still haven't come up with anything more than the fact that the one thing I can do on my own is to simply be more aware of situations like that among my own circle of friends. I can still remember that a couple of years after my father died in 1975, that my mother mentioned that most of their close friends had more or less stopped calling and stopped dropping by for a visit. You know, it was a very similar situation to that which occurs when somebody gets divorced. It seems that for some reason, many of the friends choose sides and drop their relationship with one or the other of the former partners. You know, there are really a lot of lonely people in the world, and many of them are living in the middle of a family that doesn't understand their angst, you know, their personal unhappiness. My guess is that we probably all have friends in that situation, but how often do we really reach out to them? And mainly maybe because we're in a similar state of affairs. Well, I'm just rambling now, but I think you get my drift. Now, there's one last thing I want to do to sort of close Daniel's plialogue, and that is to give you a brief idea of one of the conversations that took place after Daniel finished the formal part of his plialogue. If you remember, there was a point at which Daniel and Matt Palomary got into a small discussion about one aspect of the definition of shamanism. And in order to keep the Plyalogue more on track, we had to cut this part of the conversation short. But afterwards, Matt and Daniel got together and discovered that they really were much closer to being on the same page than they realized at the time, and mainly because I more or less cut Matteo off at the time. So he didn't have a chance to really explain in more detail what he means when he uses the word shamanism. And so to give him the opportunity to more fully explain what he meant and what he and Daniel discussed afterwards, I asked him to stop by the salon and finish his thought. So here's Matt Palomary to add his two cents or two more cents about shamanism.
I'd like to elaborate on the discussion we had about shamanism, and what I really want to do is elaborate on the definition of shamanism, because I think the point was missed in that exchange that we had. I want to start by saying that the definition of shamanism as unconditional love came from Christian Reich, who is quite the expert, and he got that from talking to shamans, and I do happen to be pretty much in agreement with it. When Daniel had mentioned that, he said we had a problem with how we think about shamanism because we're looking for a New Age hero. Well, I don't agree with that at all. I believe that's really a shallow definition, and I think it misses the point completely. I've been studying shamanism for all of my life, very intensely, for 35 years. And I've studied it from every angle and experienced it from every angle I can imagine. And the reason I was drawn to shamanism is because it goes back to the roots. It goes back to the beginning. I was studying shamanism before there was ever even anybody even heard of the New Age. So shamanism has its roots in antiquity. It's the world's first religion. Every religion in the world came from it. Shamans were the first priests. They were the first teachers. They were the first performing artists. They were the first visionaries. They were the first healers. The first doctors. This goes back to the beginning. This goes back to cavemen walking out and looking up at the sun and being in awe of creation, which is, I think, quite reinforced by Graham Hancock's wonderful book, Supernatural. I think that really, that doesn't miss the point. That makes the point. So, no, I don't believe that we're looking for a New Age hero and that it's a whitewash. I mean, I suppose some people are, and I suppose maybe a lot of the people that Daniel has come in contact with may have that viewpoint, but that really does miss the point. There was also mention of shamans work with dark energies and light spiritual energies. Well, ultimately, all is energy. From a shamanic perspective, everything is energy, and all is spirit, and spirit is energy. And a shaman, a real shaman, a true shaman, an accomplished shaman, has to know all of the energies. You have to experience the light and the darkness, so when you are confronted with the darkness, you know how to deal with it because you've been there. What shamans really are adepts at mastering energy. A true shaman is someone who masters energy. And in mastering energy, they are on a path to power. And the important thing about power is that there is always a price to pay for power. So, yeah, I've had dealings with dark shamans, quote unquote, in the Amazon, personal, face to face. I don't know if I go so far as to call it it was a bit of a confrontation, but not up front. But here is the thing. If it's a quote unquote dark shaman, and you're dealing with dark energies and trying to kill people and send poison darts and all of that stuff, they're going to pay. So they're not really fully aware. And people get caught up with a lot of shamans. I've worked with shamans and done medicine work with shamans from primitive tribes. And people go and say, oh, they're the shamans, and they everything they say is right, and this and that. And what they don't realize is that these shamans come from a primitive culture, and a lot of their beliefs are still primitive, and a lot of them are superstitious and superstitions. And there's egos, and there's petty jealousies. I was very disappointed with some of the petty jealousies that I got caught up in among some of them, which is very disappointing, because you would think, oh, there's a shaman, they're supposed to know all. Well, no, that's not the case. There are people who can learn shamanic techniques. They can even learn to do some things and manifest power in particular ways and still not have integrity. So the key to a real true shaman is integrity, because integrity goes hand in hand with power. And if you don't have integrity with power, you are going to pay. Trust me, I've seen it happen, and Lorenzo has seen it happen with someone that we've known who put themselves out as a shaman, and they didn't have integrity. Because it's very important, if you're doing true shamanic work, a true shaman, if somebody comes to them, they're exposing themselves, they're being vulnerable with this person. And a true shaman needs to respect that vulnerability and have integrity, and not only respect it, but protect it. When you work with shamans in the Amazon, and you work with ones who really know what they're doing, and you create a circle, which is a very powerful shamanic form, you basically create an energetic container where people can work out their demons or their traumas within it in a safe manner, where they won't get hurt and won't get caught up with some crazy, who knows, demonic, discarnate entity or whatever the heck, bad, dark energy that can come in. You're protected in that way. That is true shamanism. Anyone or anybody who says they are a shaman and they're not in integrity are not a true shaman. I'm sorry, that's the way it goes. And this isn't even a moralistic standpoint, a moralistic view. It has to do with power and integrity. If you're going to handle power, if you're going to have the responsibility of handling the tremendous power that is at our disposal as human beings in becoming cosmic citizens, we better have our shit together, because it will destroy us. It'll take us to places you don't even want to begin to think about. In fact, they're unimaginably dark places. So you have to have the integrity to be responsibility to handle the responsibility of the power, because we're all becoming creators if we're becoming into awareness. And if you're going to be a creator, you have to be prepared to take responsibility for what you create, which is what most people try to avoid. So there was another comment about Amazonian shamanism being the purest form of shamanism. And I would have to disagree with that also, because shamanism really is truly universal. There is, forgive me if I don't get his name correct, but I think it's Maladoma Somme. He's an African shaman. Some really incredible stuff. Black Elk, Frank Fool's Crow, American Indian shamans. You know, there are Inuit shamans in the northwest of the United States. There's Kwakiutl shamans. In every culture, I don't care where you go back to the roots, it's shamanism. People may get upset, but, you know, Buddha was a shaman. Jesus Christ was a shaman. You know, you think about Chris John's comment about the definition of shamanism, unconditional love. Take a look at the examples that Jesus Christ and Buddha gave. And those are only a couple. I could go on for forever, you know, going on with examples of people who have brought that into place. But the important point, and I want to reiterate this, is that shamanism is about mastering energy. And mastering energy is about cultivating power. But power not for the sake of power. Power for the sake of being responsible to do what is right, because it all is ultimately backed by love, and love is what creation is all about. So that's really the important thing. On one level, dark energy, light energy, there's no difference. There are just different qualities of energy. I know many people who are on the path, and they only want light experiences, and I don't want to go to the dark, and then they run away. Well, they're missing the point, because you cannot have any light without the darkness. And the darkness and the light are complementary. And I won't even go so far as to say there are two poles. They're just two ends of a spectrum that goes on infinitely. So there are degrees of light and there are degrees of darkness. And anybody who gets caught up in quote-unquote dark shamanism, in my humble opinion, they're not a shaman, because they've missed the point, because they don't understand power. Because if they truly understood the power and the nature of it and the tremendous power of power, then they wouldn't be going down that dark path, because they would have the awareness to know that there's going to be a price to pay. and it's a cliche, but there'll be hell to pay, literally. I've seen it, and I've been close enough to it and been through enough dark places myself to know of what I speak. So I'm hoping this really clears up truly what the definition of shamanism is. It's not a new age hero. Well, you know, that's all. That's whitewashed. That's not. That really doesn't make it. That misses the point totally. It's about becoming responsible for our power as creators, so we can quit fighting each other on this planet and killing each other and doing all this dark, egocentric stuff and become fully aware with integrity to become responsible cosmic citizens, so we can go on to become the truly great creators that's our inheritance to become and to be.
And so now I hope that that's cleared up a little. Mainly I wanted to kind of tie up our thoughts about shamanism, particularly after we listened to Terrence McKenna's take on it in podcast 132. But my guess is that this isn't the last we'll hear about the subject here in the salon. Now, let me get to a couple of messages from fellow saloners. The first message I want to comment on is from longtime saloner Rob, who says, "Briefly, after the Brazil experience, I have at last seemed to have found a network of people in the UK who are like-minded, organized, and conducting ayahuasca ceremonies here and overseas. My second meeting with them will be at Glastonbury. The circle grows, the medicine is powerful, and the synchronicities intensify. Your good friend Matt Palomary's advice and knowledge is part of our prep. You and your family will be in my thoughts. Thank you so much. Love and healing, Rob." Well, thanks for that, Rob. And since my family includes all of our fellow saloners here, I guess you're going to have quite a large group of us spirits along with you on your next journey. And I'm sure that a great time will be had by us all. There was also this message from Felix, who said, "Lorenzo, I was wondering about Dr. Grove's study. Is there any way we could just start a fund and have you donate it all at once? Anyway, maybe I'm being naive and not quite understanding the situation. It was an interesting format for this podcast, too, with that little bit of Terrence at the beginning. I do not agree with him, but I still find it amusing when he so bluntly dismisses yoga." Yeah, Terrence did get a bit dismissive about yoga in that last talk of his, but on other occasions I've heard him give a much more positive view about it. And if you ever want to hear a psychedelic elder talk about the importance of a good yoga practice, then take another listen to my friend Nick Sands' talk from the 2001 Mind States Conference. You can hear that talk in podcast number 37. Reflections on Imprisonment and Liberation as Aspects of Consciousness. I really can't think of a more psychedelic person than Nick, and I also don't know anyone more dedicated to yoga. So your point's really well taken, Felix. And as for your suggestion of taking up small donations for Dr. Grove, while it's really a great thought, I've been told that the record-keeping required by all of the various bodies that think they need to regulate these things would soak up most of the funds. But I'm sure that many of our fellow saloners would love to send a few dollars to Dr. Grove's study. However, right now that just isn't practical, I'm afraid. But thanks for the thought. One more email message I want to mention comes from Max, who was one of the generous donors I mentioned in the last podcast. Here's what he had to say. "You know, I was only 2 months into discovering the salon and podcasting when I actually met you last fall at the CPAC conference in San Diego. I was the guy with the iPhone with your picture on it." Yeah, I remember you really well, Max. In fact, your iPhone was the first one I ever actually got to hold, and it it really blew me away that right there on it was a picture that I used for these podcasts. You know, for a little minute there, I had sort of a psychedelic experience of my own, and on the natch, as Terrence says. Max goes on, "One more thing. Now that I've finished most of the show's archives, I have a better answer for something you asked. Back then, you asked me if there was too much McKenna on the show. So the obvious answer to that is, there's no such thing as too much McKenna. At the same time, I'd cast my vote for more of the unusual, obscure speakers once in a while. Example, an early show with Zoe Seven. I knew a little bit of his work and sometimes wondered how weird he might be in real life, so hearing him talk was quite amazing. The first talk Leary gave was great, too. Hope this helps. Thanks again. Kind regards, Max. Yes, it helps a lot, Max, and your comment is actually one of the things that prompted me to play today's plialogue in order to add some more voices to the mix, even though some of them are anonymous. And I agree with you about not getting too much of Terrence McKenna. I'm still amazed at myself for how much I still look forward to hearing one of his talks, even those I've heard before. And I don't think it's because he died so young. Even when he was alive and still on the speaking circuit, people would travel hundreds of miles just to hear him. He truly was a bard. Well, I guess that's about it for today. And as always, I want to close by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage at psychedelicsalon.org, which is also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. Oh, and one last thing. I'm going to try to get next week's podcast out by this coming Sunday morning because I'll be leaving on a little trip for the first part of the week. My wife and I are going to visit Bruce Damer and his wife, Galen Brandt, and do a little brainstorming about some possible ways that maybe we can one day bring some of these plialogues to a neighborhood near you. So stay connected for more information about that in future podcasts. But if I don't make it out with a program by next Sunday, in the next few days at least, don't worry if I'm a bit late next week. I may not get these programs out on the same day each week, like my more professional podcast friends KMO and the gang over at dopefiend.co.uk, but I am committed to getting at least one out for every week of the year, and maybe even a few more for good measure if things go as planned. Well, enough of my chatter for today. For now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.